You're listening to Building the Game with Rob and Jason.
It's Building the Game with Jason and Rob. For tabletop game design, you really can't go wrong. Building the Game, yeah, Building the Game.
Hello and welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, March 16th, 2015. You're listening to episode 146. My name's Rob. Sitting there is Jason. It's sound effects day on Building the Game. Yeah, it's another day. We're already halfway through the march. Through the march? Are we already halfway through the march?
Marching through the march.
What am I saying? Words are
being said.
Words. Hi, how's it going?
It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it? Are you sure?
Whatever, it's good.
You still sound like garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah. With what did you call this virus?
RSV.
RSV? Really poopy virus?
Yeah. I don't know what it means, but something virus.
Is it a rhinovirus?
Could be. I don't know.
I think
rhinovirus is generally more flu-like symptoms.
Is it? Okay, I don't know.
This is basically a respiratory. I think it's respiratory something virus.
RSV. Sure, yeah, yeah. Might as well. Okay.
So, I feel fine, but I'm just a little stuffy.
You sound terrible.
My throat bothering me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, good times. What's going on?
That's super fun. Driving to work this morning, there was a little news story about somebody who was who'd written a book about Monopoly.
Yeah.
It was on NPR, and it was
Crash from Flip the Table, read that book.
Yeah. It was a woman, and I don't recall the author's name, but she was talking about all the research she'd done about Monopoly and telling kind of the story and the history of that. There's a really good documentary about Monopoly that I kind of felt like already told that story pretty well.
She was like, "We need a book."
Yeah, I don't mean to be critical of the book. I haven't read it. Maybe it's a really good book, but the way she came off in the interview was as an opportunist. As if she was just, you know, it's just some journalist nice. looking for a book idea and said, "Oh, Monopoly. Huh. I bet there are people out there that would buy that book." And maybe I'm way off base. I don't know this woman at all. I don't know anything about
maybe
her.
Maybe don't buy the book, Chris.
I'm just saying that's how she came off the interview, and it was kind of a disappointment. And it was almost like it was kind of a spectacle on you know, NPR Morning News, which is... That's about as spectacular as the news gets, you know, on NPR in the mornings. You know,
right.
That's about as sensational as it gets.
Right.
Monopoly. Ooh.
I don't want you to monopolize this conversation with stories about Monopoly. So
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. What have you been up to?
I played the greatest game ever made this weekend.
Really?
Yeah.
And what is that game?
Water Balloon Washout.
Oh, yeah.
We played a 7-player game of Water Balloon Washout.
7 players. Wow, yeah, great.
So it was a lot of fun. So two decks.
Two decks, okay.
I came in third, which is really good for me.
It is really good. Usually you're out early.
I kept explaining to people how they could take other people out.
And then they wouldn't do it?
No, they did.
Oh, they would follow your instructions. Okay.
And then I would take them out. And then came down to Rowan, Alex, and I, and they caught on. And
got
they,
it.
Then they killed me.
Good. So still fun.
Yeah. It was
still
good time.
Fun. Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
So
that's good news.
Yeah. I think it's the last thing I've played, really. Mm-hmm.
I finished playing Last of Us.
Yeah, you said
it.
Oh,
man, that game, dude.
Huh?
That game is so good.
What's funny is I told you for a long time the game is awesome. Good zombies, bleh.
Well, you haven't played it, though.
No, but I mean, I kept saying, dude, I've heard this game is amazing. And
you're like,
zombies, man, stupid.
Well, my feelings about zombies are well known on this to the listeners of this show. So it did take me a while to get to it. It took me a while to get to it, and I'm glad though that I got, man, what a game. That is like, for me, like, I haven't played every game that's out there, but that is clearly, for me, game of the generation. I mean, for that PS3, Xbox 360 generation, absolutely, unquestionably game of the generation. Maybe my favorite game of all time, video game of all time.
Wow.
Like, I'm not sure, but it's up there, and I'm struggling to think of any game that I cared about more.
Wow.
And that I enjoyed playing and cared about the story and the characters more.
Wow.
I'm not sure that I can name anything. Like, previously, I probably would have said, I think Oblivion was, like, my favorite game ever. just because it was, I'd never played anything like it before. It was just so different. So, but man, Last of Us is super good.
I'll have to check it out. I got to download it.
It's really good. Yeah. Highly recommend it. Anybody out there is listening who's not played Last of Us and has a PS3 or a PS4, you should play Last of Us.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. I think you can get it pretty cheap now too.
Sweet.
Yeah. That's what was occupying my time. I started playing Thief. That was the free PlayStation 3 Plus game.
Yeah, how's that?
For February. It's okay. It got pretty bad reviews. I think I got through the first couple of chapters and it was fine. I don't know. I'll keep going. Maybe I'll burn out or maybe it'll get stupid. I don't know. Maybe it'll jump the shark. But I'm enjoying that for now. So we'll see. Yeah.
All right.
That's my gaming. Oh, and I've been playing Heroes Charge.
I downloaded that, man. That game looked really stupid.
It's pretty dumb.
I stopped playing it.
It's pretty dumb, yeah. It's just, it's little, I've probably played that for a total of about 4 hours total, and I probably had enough. I'm probably about at my max, but yeah. For a free little free-to-play thing, that's fine. I mean, 4 hours, that's okay. You could go pretty deep into that and spend a lot of money on it if you wanted to, but yeah, that's not my...
People
do that. My thing.
People love doing that.
They do. Some people.
So.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we're looking for a topic for this week.
We were.
We tweeted, because that's what we do when we can't think of a topic. Mm-hmm. And,
like every week.
Right. Yep. And Ben Pinchback came through.
What a guy.
Yeah, what a guy. He said he'd like us to talk about, I'd like you to talk about making a theme work with mechanics, and in addition to that, making it connect with the game players. So, it's interesting that you mentioned Last of Us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's a game where I've heard that the story kind of rules, but that the theme and the mechanics fit pretty well together.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly you get a connection from that because the game like super moved you and makes you think it's the best game ever. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think go play Last of Us and that's the end of our discussion.
Well, so let me think about that. So what is it about that game mechanically that connects it so effectively with the theme and the story?
One of the things that I, having not played it, read about that I thought was amazing was that when you're crafting things, nothing stops. It's not like pause the game. Like,
you don't go to the crafting menu.
Right.
Yeah.
No, you're crafting stuff. Well,
there is a crafting menu, but it doesn't pause. Yeah.
Right.
Right. So that's one thing that it does, and I think more games are doing that these days. I think actually Zombie U that came out when the Wii U came out was another good example of that, where if you have to craft something, you have to look down at your little Wii U gamepad, and the game's still going. So you could be a zombie could be attacking you while you're not even looking at this TV screen,
right?
You know, because you're looking at your backpack.
That's really smart.
Yeah, so I think some more video games, when it makes sense, are doing that kind of thing. I think that was the first time I'd seen that before was with Last of Us. I might have missed it before, but yeah. So that's a cool feature. I mean, the game has combat in it, but it offers you a lot of opportunity to either fight or go stealth. You know, just to sneak around past people and avoid detection. So you don't have to murder a bunch of dudes if you don't want to.
Right.
It's tougher. And especially when you play it on easy, like I do, it's a lot easier just to kill everybody than it is try and sneak around.
Right, right.
Because when I try and sneak around them, I inevitably end up just alerting them to my presence and fighting them anyway.
Right.
Because I'm bad at stealth in games. That's why I play things on easy so that I can get through the combat and still see the story. Anyway, so it's pretty smart about that. But we don't need to talk about video games. We're talking about tabletop games.
I was just bringing it up because you mentioned it. So, okay, tabletop games. Give me a tabletop game where the theme and the mechanics fit so seamlessly that they just speak to the players.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm just waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
What you got there?
I'm just watching you yawn.
Because I'm bored waiting for you to answer my question.
Because you have two kids and you don't get enough sleep.
It's true. That's not the only reason why I don't get enough sleep.
Because you also stay up too late and don't get enough sleep just on your own. Right. So I'm struggling here. So mechanics that fit well with the theme. Okay. So
seamlessly
with the theme. is that even a fair statement? I mean, are we just trying to look for themes that, or for mechanics that don't clash with the theme or don't detract from the theme? Because when it comes to tabletop gaming, we all know at some measure we're going to be rolling dice, we're going to be shuffling and dealing cards, and we're going to be moving pieces around. So maybe we shouldn't. Is there even an example of something that like really serves that mechanically serves the theme and encourages the theme and that the two go together? Maybe we should just thinking about what does not detract from the theme.
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the main things, if you're a designer and you want to be someone who really focuses on theme, one of the best pieces of advice I can give you is every mechanic must be justified and mesh with the theme.
Yeah.
So like if you say, why would I do this? Like when AJ and I talk about Ramblers, this happens a lot. He says, okay, that sounds cool. How would you justify that with a theme?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't think of a good reason, he'll be like, then we're not going to do it. Yeah. because he's super concerned about that. That's one of his big things, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I am too. So I think that if you want your theme to flow perfectly with your game, that's the number one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that helps people connect, right? Because then it feels seamless. It doesn't feel like, okay, now I'm rolling dice. Now I'm doing this, you know, Gunslinging Ramblers, man, that's going to come with a bottle of whiskey and 2 6-shooters because I want you to shoot each other and drink whiskey. So,
So that's a good example. Cashing guns is one of those things where you're pointing guns at each other, sure, and that actually is pretty seamless. You know, another one is Flower Fall, where you're dropping cards,
right?
You know, like falling flowers. You're dropping flowers, trying to get them together.
It's right there in the name.
Yeah. So okay, so those are good examples where that mechanic is pretty tightly compacted within the theme and with the theme. Those are outliers, though, you know. Like if anything, like okay, and I think about Camel Up,
right?
And I think as cool as that, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. As cool as that pyramid is, I think it's a pain in the butt and it detracts from the game for me. I mean, visually on the table, it is like, man, holy cow, what a cool thing! I totally want to see what this is. But when it comes down to it, I'd much rather just be drawing a die out of a bag. Because that's not a gimmick. That's a mechanic. The pyramid is a gimmick.
It's a gimmick that serves a mechanic.
And makes it more complicated.
Not really. You push a button on a pyramid.
It's well, and sometimes hard. It jams. And you got to turn it over and shake it. And
usually use your air.
Well, that's true. But there's no opportunity for user error with a fabric bag.
You can drop the bag.
Oh, all right. It might get a little dirty from the floor. That's true.
Dice might roll out.
Yeah.
You know, I think of a game like Parade, which is an abstract theme, right? It has a theme, but it doesn't matter
at
all.
Yeah, it's right. That's,
There's no thematic justification for why people come out of the parade, like when you pull them out.
And why it's Alice in Wonderland themed. Right. And, yeah.
Because that would sell copies, and it did, because it's cool. It's a great game, but it's abstract. The theme doesn't mean anything. You have to, obviously, if it's a game like that, you don't really have to justify things with a theme. I mean, the name of the game is Parade. It's people in a parade. You've done your work for theme. That's it. Like, that's, you know what I mean? And that's not like a full-on abstract game, obviously, but the theme is pasted on, right?
Yeah, definitely.
The theme was pasted on with sweet artwork to sell the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how about Risk? Risk is a good middle zone. Risk is a big game. It's a game where mechanically you're pushing pieces around on a big map of the world.
Right.
Okay, so that's pretty seamless, you know, because that's a clear representation of your how much territory you're controlling the world and your domination and how many armies you have built. So that is like basically a one-to-one connection between theme and mechanics. So,
okay,
that's an excellent example. All right, I'm getting up to speed now. So the question again that Ben had was how do you encourage that? Find it again? Faster?
How about the trick to making the theme fit the mechanics? How do you help players make the connection as a designer?
Okay. All right. So how do you make that connection? Well, so that's going to vary a lot based on what that theme is. So we think about this a lot, don't we? Like when we had with where smithereens came from, right?
Right.
The request was to make an engine destroying game, and so I wanted to come up with an engine destroying game, and I thought, well, so before I can decide how this works, I need to pick a theme to go with it. I need something that works. So that's why I started with this airships theme, falling out of the sky, and that led me to something. Once I had the theme in mind and what I wanted the action to be within that theme, within the story or the narrative of the game, because, you know, I like to think of, in terms of a narrative. Once I had that narrative in my mind in a general sense, I had to think about, okay, what would work for that? What would not get in the way of that? And trying to keep it simple. I'm working on another idea right now that I'll probably pitch in the future that, you know, maybe I'll just pitch that game tonight instead of the other one, because this is kind of helpful for this.
Okay.
I was going to pitch another one, but I'm super fuzzy on that one. And this one is a new idea that I don't know.
Okay.
Man, I feel like I'm struggling tonight.
I've noticed. So yeah. Have listeners, to be honest.
Yeah, I bet. Man, I'm all discombobulated.
Okay, so let's just get back to the thing.
Yeah, sorry.
So yeah, the first thing you need to be able to do is, the more you can justify your mechanics to your theme, the better time you're going to have with making players connect with that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think is super important about this that some people forget is the more your theme meshes with the mechanics, the easier the mechanics can be to remember.
That's right? Absolutely true.
Because they feel intuitive. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, oh, I got to do this to do that. Right. Of course. That makes total sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have to feed people or they starve to death.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? Yeah. Okay. You're absolutely right. So anytime you can make that make sense, the game's going to be easier to learn and probably more fun to play. So think about how this theme, this action would actually play out. And right. then how can that be represented with pieces of cardboard and plastic?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you want to think about, how would this work if this was a story or mm-hmm. if this was a film or a book or whatever? Mm-hmm. And then say to yourself, how can mechanically I make that work? Now, that said, you can work at it backwards, right? I mean, you can start with some mechanics and then say, hey, what does this mechanic feel like? What kind of theme does this mechanic feel like? We do that all the time. When you have this cool idea for a mechanic, and then you try and work backwards to a theme. And you can do that and still have a game that feels completely just drenched in theme.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's any harder. I would say it's about the same, because you really just are thinking from a perspective of how do I make these things align? You know, sometimes that may even be easier. I mean, I don't know. I always find that I do well when I have a theme that I really, really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it easy to say, okay, this is how this would make me feel for real. So let's try and turn that into pieces of cardboard, you know?
Yeah. All right. You just gave much better comments on that than I did in the last 10 minutes. So
yeah, I'm aware.
You win.
Yay.
You win. So we done with that?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like we fumbled through that pretty much on par with how we typically fumble through things. So no worries.
Listeners, tell us we're wrong. Give us some feedback.
Yeah, make more intelligent comments than we've been able to come up, please. We need your help. Builders, we count on you guys. So I guess I'm going to pitch a game now, huh?
Yeah.
I'm really unprepared for this. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about trading, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted I was working on a game idea that I wanted to make because I wanted to put trading into it. And man, I just haven't gotten anywhere on it in a couple of weeks. And it's really frustrating. And so I was going to try and pitch that and see if you could maybe help me out with it. But I just still feel like it's not quite there. So I had this other idea earlier today that I was just toying with. Wasn't even going to pitch it, but let's go for it. Last summer, when my wife and I went to Scotland and England, for vacation, I think I talked about this a little bit on the show. We spent a day in Edinburgh in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a kind of the old town, the old part of the town, It's a road that leads up from kind of ground level up a big hill up to Edinburgh Castle, which is the top of this hill, and it's kind of surrounded by cliffs on three sides, and then this long sloping hill down the other side, and that's called, if my memory serves me correctly, it's called King's Road, and it's a gentle slope. Lengthwise up to the castle, but it's very, very steep on either side down to the lock. Well, down to the lock on one side and down to, I think it's like a kind of what used to be in medieval days, I think it was like a swampy area on the other side. So, and there were these medieval tenement buildings that were built, on these slopes. And so what was on, you know, ground level on the King's Road level, maybe there was a three-story building there. That building would extend outward and down the slope, down the hill, down to the lock. So what was a three-story building, the King's Road might be a 12-story building down by the lock.
Okay.
So the roof level is the roof, basically the entire length of the building, the roof is the same, the same level, but there become like more and more practically sub basements, deeper and deeper and deeper, as it goes down. Okay.
Right.
In these medieval housing, you know, there was no plumbing, there was no electricity, there's no running water or anything, and horrible cold, icy winters in Scotland. And so in the winter, they would, you know, everybody would just throw all their waste out the windows. And, so all the people who lived up high on the upper floors, they were nice. They were comfortable. It was great. Cause all their waste would go out the window and fall down in the street below.
Right.
And so all the people who lived on the kind of the street level down would be swallowing in just filth.
Right.
In these horrible slums. And of course in the winter when that would all freeze, and there would just be like just an icy chute all the way down to the lock that was just horribly polluted and foul and disgusting. Right. And the roads between these buildings were so narrow in some cases, they didn't call them roads, they didn't even call them alleys, they would call them closes. So it's close. In some cases, this close could be 3 or 4 feet wide between the buildings. That's the street between these buildings. It was only a few mm-hmm. feet wide. You know, big, wide enough so that you couldn't even get a cart down these.
Right.
Really, really fascinating stuff. And then at one point in the city's history, the city said, "Look, we're tired of this. We need to build a new city hall." And so they just basically kicked everybody out. Oh, and of course, this place was horribly ravaged by the plague.
Right.
When the Black Plague was coming through. So at some point, the government said, "Look, we're sick of all this stuff, and we want to build a new city hall." So they just like kicked everybody out of these buildings, and they sealed them off, and then they just cut the tops of these buildings off all at the King's Road level, okay? And they sealed them up, and they built a new city hall on top of that and said, "This is the new ground level, period."
Right.
And all the stuff that was below here, we're just going to pretend it never existed.
Right.
And then I think sometime in the 60s or the 70s, archaeologists said, "I wonder if there's anything still down there," and broke in and found floors, many, many floors of medieval era plague homes that had just been sealed up and forgotten about for hundreds of years. Completely perfect condition. I mean, they were old and decaying, of course, but in perfect condition. And it's just a fascinating place, fascinating history. Yeah. It's well worth looking up and reading about. And one of these areas, they turned into a tourist attraction there in Edinburgh, and we went through that, and it was amazing stuff. And of course, you know, everything in my brain is going, "Oh man, there's so many story ideas here, so many opportunities for creative stuff to explore." And I've been trying to come up with a game for this forever. Something finally just hit me today. Because I was thinking about, you know, where's the story there? Where's the story? What's the game? Is the story exploring these things in modern times, or is it something set in medieval days when the plague is ravaging through there, and you're trying to run around through these things? But I think what I decided on is it's about building these bizarre tenement housing structures. Okay.
Okay.
So, and you're not building a 3D thing on the table, as much as I'd like to do that. It's not Saloon Tycoon 2.
Tenement Tycoon.
Yeah. It's not that. It's a tile game. It's a tile placing game. Okay. But we're not like laying out a map of the city in this case. Everybody in front of them has their own individual player board. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of it like a side view of these buildings. Okay. And there's kind of a stair-stepped cutout that is think of that as the ground level or the foundation of the building. Okay, and on the far right is it's high, and then the far left it's low. Okay, and then it's stair step down. We're gonna say there's six steps across. Okay. And then when you're placing tiles, you can place them basically onto these stairs. Okay, so the top stair is ground level, is King's Road level. Okay, and the bottom stair is the lock, is the lowest part of it.
Right.
And so as you're playing the game, you're going to be buying tiles from a supply, and you're spending cards to buy those tiles, and you're going to be placing them onto your board to build this structure. And you always have to build from ground level up, or okay, from foundation level up. And now here's the thing, though. At the end of the game, you're only going to get points for... at the end of the game, the city's going to come in and kick everybody out, right? And they're just going to wipe everybody else out of there, and all the tenants and things, and because they're going to take it over. But you, as the owner of this building, as the called the developer, whatever, because they're going to compensate you a little bit. So they're going to compensate you for anything that you've built on the King's Road level or higher.
Okay.
So basically, yeah, you have room for I counted it out in this diagram, but you have room for 21 buildings above King's Road level and 21 buildings below King's Road level.
Okay.
So they will give you points for anything at King's Road level or higher. Everything else is you're not going to get anything for that. Period. That's it. So you want to build upward. You definitely want to build upward, but you can only build up to three levels above King's Road, three floors above King's Road. So once you get that up, you're going to have to keep going out and out and out and out.
Right.
All
right.
There are three different types of tiles that are going to be worth different points for final scoring. You've got basic housing, which is not over much. You're going to have call it a workshop, some kind of construction or something.
Mm-hmm.
People are producing things. I don't want to call it factories because factory implies it's a big thing and it's like a a small section. So we'll call it a workshop. And then you've got some kind of retail space or a storefront.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so those are worth different values. And of course they cost more or less to buy. On a turn, at any given time, I'm thinking this is up to a six-player game. At any time, there could be as many tiles available for sale as there are players. Well, let's just say that. As many.
Okay.
So if there's six players, there's six tiles out there for sale. As soon as somebody buys one, they buy that new one comes out. Okay, and they just have a cost on there. Your cards that you have some kind of special power or ability or action on the card, but they also have a value in, say, gold, for lack of a better term. And so you could either play that for special power or you can spend that as gold to buy one of these tiles and place it in there. Okay. And on your turn, you're basically either playing cards or you're buying tiles to build your thing. Now, the thing that makes it different, though, is that sometimes the plague might show up.
Right.
So there's these plague cards. You can play a plague card on another player, and you can choose a foundation level location where the plague has appeared in their building. Okay. So any building that is on ground level, foundation level, the lowest level in that column, plague can show up there. And what you're going to do then is you're going to flip that tile over, and there's any skull and crossbones in the back of those tiles or something like that. So basically, that means the city has come in, the plague doctors come in and seal off that piece of the structure. Okay. Can't do anything with it. But the plague's going to spread because that's what plague does. So what you need to do then is that player who's been hit by the plague, then they have to, if they can play a card from their hand, if they have a card in their hand that allows them to stop the plague, they can stop the plague. It's not going to go anywhere. But if they don't have a card in their hand to stop it, then they're going to flip a card over from the deck. And they're looking for an icon on the card that says that this stops the plague, like a medicine icon or something.
Yeah.
Okay. If they flip a card and that does not stop the plague, then the next floor above that, it becomes plague ridden and gets sealed off, flipped over. And then they have to keep doing that, flipping cards until they get something that allows them to stop the plague in its tracks. But then all those tiles that have been plague ridden are now locked. And if that gets up so high that it's above King's Road level, then those floors that are getting hit are lost.
Right.
You're not going to get points from the beginning of the game because they're sealed off.
Right.
Other things about the history of the close there, there's a legendary ghost that lives in there. It's pretty famous. They've done a lot of TV shows and things about it. People from all over the world bring toys to this ghost now these days and put them in the room. Actually, we went to the room in the tour. And they said, if there's anybody here who brought a toy, now's your opportunity to put it down here for the ghost. Nobody in our group did, but apparently that's a pretty common thing. What was the other thing? Of course, there's plenty of stories about murders and things. And so, there would have to be some kind of situation there where there could be a murder in someone's thing and police come investigate or something. Right, I don't know. Right. All that to be worked out. But so that's kind of the basic idea. What I'm trying to think about is some kind of restrictions about how you place your tiles, like maybe some kind of a color system where you can only build, a blue tile on top of a blue tile, or every tile has two colors on it,
Right.
Or maybe even something that's connect them next to each other. You can only build a red next to a red or something like that. And I'm not sure exactly how to make that work, because in order for the tile placing to be more challenging and not just I'll get one, now you get one, now you get one, now you get one, I need there to be some kind of other restriction or requirement there in building it to make it more interesting.
Right.
And help you with your choice instead of always trying to buy the most expensive one.
Well, you could do the opposite of saying, like, there cannot be a red tile within X squares of a red tile. So actually do the opposite of that.
Oh, okay. Just like, keep it real simple like that.
Retail is red, say. You can't have a retail that close to another retail. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You have to keep them spread out.
But maybe you want to keep housing together.
Right. That would say, but housing has to go next to each other. So that's what breaks the rule. How do you, what point in the game do you score? At the end?
At the end is when you would score, and you would, again, only score what's on Kings Road level and above.
Right.
And I'm not sure exactly what the game end scenario is. Maybe it's when the tiles run out.
Okay.
That would be kind of the simplest idea for that.
Okay. That sounds interesting. I mean, you need to do a lot of work with it, obviously.
Yeah, it's still super early. It's not not a fully formed idea right now, but I think it's... there's a crack in it that I didn't have before.
The theme is great, though.
I just love the setting of it. I really, truly, anybody who's out there who's interested in this, you should read as much as you can about the history of Edinburgh and Mary King's Close. It's fascinating stuff. Really fascinating stuff. It. Yeah. And there's the plague tore through there and just devastated everything.
Yeah.
Horrible stuff. I mean, when you think about medieval history, you're thinking about what it was like in Edinburgh in that time,
right.
just the iconic medieval city with all the problems and situations that go with that concept.
Right.
So it's cool stuff. Yeah.
Crazy.
I don't know. I'd hoped to have a bigger, a more fleshed out pitch for that,
but
that's what we got.
Let the listeners down like normal.
Yeah.
Hey, we have one Twitter question.
Oh, good.
Before we go. Seth Goslin says, Jason likes to design games with variable player powers. Mm-hmm. Rob seems less so.
Yep.
Is that related to the games you like to play?
Ooh. I don't play a lot of games with variable player powers.
And I do.
Yeah.
So, yes.
I guess so.
See, here's the thing, Seth Goslin. Variable player powers are fun, and Jason likes fun. Rob, less so. As you said in your email, so your Twitter or tweeter, whatever, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Anyways, so yeah, no, I like variable player powers. I seek out games that have that because I think it's fun. I also design games like that. So I think that is probably a good reason why. And you struggle with variable player powers. Like
I do a lot.
People kind of get you to put in a game and you're like, I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. And I've toyed with that with Tea Party, Monster Tea Party, right, off and on. And it's just nothing is really feeling right for me.
Right.
With that. Yeah, no, I struggle. I guess I don't really play many games with special powers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love them.
Yeah. I don't know. I like balance,
Yeah.
Like balance.
Certainly harder to balance the games with variable player powers.
I like everyone starting from the same footing and then expanding from there and customizing. Like, I guess the only game that I've played several times with different player powers, and that's maybe not even an example, but Mansions of Madness.
Okay.
Characters start
in the multiverse too.
Oh yeah, good. Well, yeah. Well, that's basically the whole game is player powers.
Right.
And that's, I feel like that's kind of in a different category.
Right.
Because for my conception, it's everybody is, you know, 75 to 80% of what you're doing is the same, and you have that 20, 25% that is unique to you.
Right.
You know, whereas Sentinels, everybody's doing 100% their own thing.
Right.
But all working on the same goal.
25% that's the, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So it basically flips that on its head. Right. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
That's a good question, though.
It is a good question. Yeah. I guess I just don't play many of those. But what I was saying about Mansions of Madness, and that's, and I'm just not really sure that they have really variable powers. It's just variable or different starting equipment and starting stats. And that's just an RPG.
Right.
You know, an RPG trope there. So anyway, I don't know, man. What a, episode 146 is going to go down history as a mess, I think.
It's not the first. Won't be the last.
Yeah, boy. I don't know. Just a mess. Just a sad, sad, pitiful mess.
Well, on that note, let's not extend it. Let's okay. just call it a night.
Let's just call it a night. Okay, thanks for listening. Sorry, builders. We owe you one here. If you want to get in touch with us, send us an email, buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at podcastBTG. Jason, J.A. Slingerland. I am at poorly_design. Like us on Facebook. 5-star review on iTunes. Well, I mean, I guess it's not fair for me to ask for that today.
Nope, it is. Maybe skip this week, but next week get back to it.
Yeah.
Like us on Board Game Links.
Board Game Links, yes. Thank you. Like us on Board Game Links. Check out our website. Call our Google Voice number, 770-TEL-BTG. We need some voicemails, please. Or if you want to email us a voice recording, send it to buildinggamepodcast@gmail.com. That's enough. Good night.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios. All of the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are property of the Building the Game podcast. Next time on Building the Game.
It's a... Ooh.